My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead, and it's been my pleasure to help recruit and provide logistics for getting teaching faculty this summer. So it's my pleasure to introduce Kristen Benson for another month as from a professor at North Dakota State University and a former colleague of mine and a good friend. So I so appreciate her being here, and she is moving to Appalachia. You know, the Midwest in me, I just cannot deal with the state university in about another month. So we're sad in Fargo, but happy for you.
Thank you. So
Kristen's topic today is understanding gender identity and gender diversity, and she's going to be exploring gender identity terminology, self-exploration of gender, and inclusive gender diversity. So thank you, Kristen.
Thank you. Welcome. Thanks for showing up. It's beautiful out. I tried to open some of the shades up so it weren't so dark in here. So we have a couple of trajectories that we can go today. So I'd like to start by doing some introductions, and then we can decide what route we want to take. Every time I engage in these kinds of conversations with people, people are bringing different ideas, different backgrounds, different personal experiences. And I want to honor that, so that if you are somebody who maybe knowledge is constructed but knows a lot, then we don't want this to be too elementary. But at the same time, for some folks, there might be just terminology words you don't know. So I kind of set it up, and then we can veer from the PowerPoint. But what I do want to say to start is that oftentimes in these discussions, and this isn't an expectation, but it sometimes happens, people self-disclose. So this is a session that's being recorded. However, we are going to edit or delete as appropriate to protect your privacy. You know, something that would be heard by others, we wouldn't want anything that is revealing to you but might be relevant to our dialogue and conversation today. I don't see myself as an expert, and I don't want this to be just me talking at you. I mean, I'm hoping that we'll have some dialogue, so I don't want that to be a barrier. So if our conversation seems like it's appropriate for other people to be able to listen to later, great. If not, we will take appropriate action to just honor what is, you know, whatever happens in our time together today. Does that sound okay to everyone? So I'm Kristen. Like Sharon mentioned, I'm kind of between two positions. But I love engaging in these conversations, and I started doing this work 13 years ago, before Caitlyn Jenner was popular, before we heard about bathroom bills and people's livelihood being debated. It was just an area. I'm a family therapist. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I was in my doctoral program, and I decided to do the new Women and Gender Studies graduate certificate at Virginia Tech, and I took a gender theory course. And it was kind of like a no-duh moment. Why didn't you get this before? And I was sitting in this class going, why haven't we ever talked about intersex kids, and why haven't we ever talked about gender identity in any of my classes? And I've gone to great programs. And we talk about LGBT, but generally it's because a student brought it up, and we were really only talking about the L and the G. We really weren't talking about the B, and we especially were talking about the T. So it really changed the course of my dissertation work, my research interests, my advocacy, and really my career from that point. In the sessions coming later this week, I'll talk about two different research projects, but today will be more conversation about our understandings of gender and gender identity, if that's what you all want to do. So I come from Florida originally, so going to North Carolina is taking me closer back home, but here I'm by way of a three-day drive from Fargo, North Dakota.
There was a conversation I had with our daughter, and she has a 2-year-old. And she and her friend, they were playing, and her friend had a little boy, and they were saying, she had said later, oh, wouldn't it be really weird if they grew up and got married? And our very youngest daughter, who was 26 at the time, said, what are you talking about? She hasn't even picked her gender yet. And yep. We all kind of went, oh, I guess she doesn't pick her gender yet. I mean, what? It hadn't even dawned on us that she might pick her gender. We had already made her a girl. Mm-hmm. And that kind of broke my heart a little bit, that I was making assumptions.
Yeah.
And so it's time.
Well, you were reflecting a social norm, right? We were socialized to.
Yeah, and I, It just like it just never even entered. I mean, I had no awareness in there. So
well, it you know, I think about when people come up to somebody who's pregnant. First of all, they touch their abdomen, which is never okay. Why that seems okay is beyond me. And then they say, "What are you having?" And what I like to reflect back to folks is we don't even have to specify what that means. Like, they're not talking about lunch, right? We don't have to say, I mean, what else? If I just walked up to Molly and said, what do you have in Molly? I mean, she might tell me about her tea, but it, you know, what does that mean? You've got to tell me more. But when somebody is pregnant, we're talking about what sex are we going to assign that fetus in order to determine what their gender will be so we can start making sense of who they're going to be in the world. Right, and that is, we are all socialized like that in Western culture. So if I can alleviate a little bit of the feeling bad part, it's saying, yeah, so we have these dialogues, these conversations, so that we can start thinking a little bit differently and being maybe more aware of the spectrum of diversity in people's experiences.
Sounds and, like straight privilege. It's that's just like white
it's,
privilege.
Yeah, kind of.
Sounds like it.
Cisnormativity. So cisgender, and well, I'm going to jump ahead. When I refer to cisgender, which is sometimes a little controversial, but we're going to use it because I don't have a better word, we're basically talking about people who are not transgender. So I am a cis person. I was assigned female at birth. I identify as a woman. So that cis means same. So there's a lot of things I don't have to think about, which we'll explore a little bit more. But when we're talking about cisgender, we're talking about people who identify with the sex and thus the related gender that they were assigned at birth. I want to point out that age two, this has come up a few times, and I think I saw some eyebrows kind of raised when somebody was mentioning about a two-year-old. That's developmentally appropriate. So my undergrad degree is in child development, and so I always find this piece fascinating. The difference between sexual orientation and gender identity, where gender identity develops very young, sexual orientation comes later. So kids as young as 2 and 3 are getting a sense of their own gender and the gender of the people around them and what their gender identity is. So it is not unusual for a 2 or 3 year old to say, I want to wake up a boy tomorrow, if they've been assigned female at birth. That doesn't necessarily mean that child is or will be transgender, but it also doesn't mean that they're too young to know what's going on with them. So this is where ethical medical and mental health practice is so important to kind of know all the nuances around these particular issues. But it's very different from saying a two-year-old might be gay because sexual orientation develops later. So we know that from the child development literature. But we conflate sexual orientation and gender identity quite a bit. Sexual orientation being who are we attracted to? Who do we want to be with? Who are we romantically interested in? Versus our identity in terms of how do I see myself? Who am I in the world? Do I identify in a masculine way, a feminine way, a way that kind of combines both of them? And that's really specific to where we're socially located as well, and the point in time, because gender changes. I remember when I was in high school, boys did not wear nail polish. It's totally been a thing. I mean, I'm so going to date myself when I say this, but it's like emo now, right? Like, guys can wear black nail polish, but they're probably not going to wear, like, French tips. Right, because there's a gender to French tips that is different from black nail polish. But 20 years ago, black nail polish, any kind of nail polish, you didn't find on a boy. Because gender norms change. The way we express gender and what's considered normative in our culture shifts over time. So I think that's important to say, too, because what we think of as a girl thing and a boy thing changes. None of it is static because we're constantly constructing it. So anyway, I can go on tangents about this stuff, but we have two directions we can go. So one is, I'm going to pull up the learning objectives. I have a PowerPoint that I put together because, you know, that's what you do when you work in academia. Everything is on PowerPoint. And that can lead us to some community conversation, interrupt at any time. We can stop at any point and kind of go in the direction you want, or we can abandon it completely all together and construct something completely new. Do you all have preferences? I guess I could pull up the learning objectives and then you can tell me if you have a preference. How about that? So when I submitted my proposal to Holden, this is what I put together. So I just pulled it right here. And that is to talk about terminology, experience, have some conversation once we understand experience about discrimination. And then exploring aspects of what it means to be cisgender, because once we understand what our privileges are, we can better understand how other people don't have access to the same resources necessarily. I don't say that with the assumption that everybody in the room is cisgender or gender diverse. What I don't do, and some of you who are maybe in academic settings or do work in social organizing, there've been some movements to, you know, when you have your name tags to put your gender markers and your pronouns. There's also been some pushback about that. So I do not do that because in shared, so people would say, like, I'm Kristen, I identify as a woman, my pronouns are she, her, hers. I don't do that in shared spaces because the other side of that is that it forces people to either disclose in a group when they don't want to, or to have to further experience marginalization by not being true to who they are, by not saying who they are because they don't feel comfortable doing it in a group. So there's some, you know, again, it's some cis privilege that allows people to start doing some of that outside of trans-specific groups. Now, that would be very different if it was a support group for people who are on the gender spectrum somewhere and it's kind of a contained group. But since we don't know who's here today, I didn't do that. But that's related to kind of see tangent, like related to this. So do you want to kind of want to stick with this, or do you want to go in another direction, or are there things that you all want to cover that aren't here?
How long is your little?
Kind of depends how we go. I mean, it can.
Let's start here.
Let's start here. Okay. All right.
It's good to hear the difference between age determination of sexual orientation and gender. Mm-hmm. You know, so just terminology.
You know, and something I didn't say during the intro is I do not profess to be an expert on anybody else's life. And I think, ideally, it's really important that we create spaces for trans people to tell their stories. So I'm very intentional as a researcher, as an educator, that I'm an advocate, but particularly to hold people from my own social group more accountable. So I don't think that it's my job to speak on behalf of people in a group that I'm not a part of. And at the same time, I have some insider, like unbeknownst to me, I was partnered with somebody who self-identified as trans and I didn't know it at the time, and now they are transitioning. You know, so I do have some of the partner experience, but I don't want to profess to know something that's outside of my own lived experience. And I think that's really important in these conversations to acknowledge it and talk about it. Because there, unfortunately, are people who are doing this kind of work on the backs of marginalized groups, and that can be really problematic. And not speaking maybe accurately or reflective in ways that feel respectful. All right, so we'll jump in then. And I want to start kind of broad and go back to some of that social commentary. And so I love that you talked about gender, because if you see, do any of this familiar? Like, why do people get freaked out about gender? Well, it organizes everything, right? So here we have, oh gosh, now I'm forgetting the name that Angelina and Brad's child was named Shiloh, but is going by
a
masculine
John on the cover.
Does it say it on there?
Yeah. In this little white text underneath.
John! Oh, he's going by John. Thank you. Just too obvious. Put it on the PowerPoint. All right, so you see the little pictures from when John was very little, then more recent, and they, you know, this comes from, like, the popular mags on celebrities, but, you know, we're showing the little girl contrasted with the little boy. Right, and what, here this headline, why is Angelina turning Shiloh into a boy? Which is quite reflective of the experience of many parents, especially moms, that somehow or another, the gender identity of their child is their fault, or the toy that they played with. And I invite everybody to think about, like, does Barbie have that much power? Barbie does not have fairy dust, Barbie does not change how we experience ourselves, Barbie is a toy. Right? Same thing with a toy gun, same thing with climbing a tree. We attribute things to gender, but you know, no parent has the power to change the gender of their child. But yet we hear these conversations. I mean, it's on the front page of a magazine.
Yeah.
It's a headline. Do you think people looked at that and said, oh, that's not true? Or do people go, ooh, what is Angelina doing?
They looked at it and bought it.
Right, exactly, right? Like, they're selling these stories, literally selling these stories. And we are buying these stories, literally paying money to buy these stories. Over here, we have Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith's child who wears dresses and has been involved in some campaigns and identifies as a man, as a boy, man, post-adolescent, but wear dresses. And this has been in the news quite a bit, right? Violating gender norms. And this is my favorite, and I'm sorry, my students, I teach an undergrad sexuality class, and I am so like the feminist killjoy fun ruiner. Because, and I'm sorry if you are a person who loves gender reveal parties, because we are going to pick that apart a little bit, based on what I said earlier, but we have this here, little man, little lady. Just sit with that. So this is an in utero fetus that we're talking about, or baby, however you want to think about, somebody who's pregnant. This is not a child that has made their way into the world that we know anything about, aside potentially like who their parents are, right? And this is a thing now. There are cakes and balloons, and is everybody familiar with gender reveal parties? You go to the doctor, you find out the, now here's the funny thing. Is it gender or sex? We're gonna talk about language, but what we're talking about is sex, but nobody wants to have a sex reveal party for a baby. So they call it gender reveal party. So we're even conflating language, and we'll define sex and gender in just a minute. But those, they do not share terminology, they are related. So we don't want to have a sex reveal party, but, you know, and it can be fun for people. If you are into these, I'm certainly not here to discredit, but it does reflect a social norm that we've probably lived for a long time, and that is, who is this person going to be, and how do we want to start making sense of them? And then there's some research that shows, and some of the parent extension people can maybe talk a little bit more about that, but the difference between the way baby boys are treated versus baby girls are treated, the kinds of like rough and tumble versus not, where girls are, you know, even the way they're lifted up by their parents can be more delicate, especially dads. You know, that there are differences based on things that really have no biological necessity. Like, girls aren't more fragile than boys. They all have pretty bendy bones. They're pretty resilient, those little tiny people. But we treat them differently because we have norms that tell us they're different because of our assumptions and ideas about gender. Does that make sense to everyone? So none of us are immune to this. We socialize it and we see it all the time. This is another one. I just have one more example because I love this one. Now, poor Jenna just left J. Crew, if any of you are J. Crew fans. But she's been like kind of the face of J. Crew for many years. And this was a couple years ago in the J. Crew Summer Catalog. Anybody see it before? Aware of this issue? Oh, the media went wild. The people went wild because this is her and her little son. And the quote at the bottom is quality time. Lucky for me, I ended up with a boy whose favorite color is pink. Toenail painting is way more fun. And the backlash to this ad. The backlash. How could she do this to her son? This is child abuse. This is child neglect. You know, this is wrong. And I thought that is a powerful bottle of nail polish. Now what it does is it socialates, it violates everything we know about social norms around gender. So it does make people uncomfortable. It does violate, you know, the way that we maybe learn from our parents or learn from our families or learn from our social settings about what girls are supposed to do and what boys are supposed to do. However, is that child abuse? No, absolutely not. As somebody who's worked with Child Protective Services, I can attest it is not child abuse. And that toenail polish will have nothing to do with his gender identity or his sexual orientation. It just doesn't work that way. But the backlash, the rhetoric, it still exists. And it especially exists in religious spaces and from religious organizations. And this is where we also want to be well-informed, because if we are providing support and advocacy for folks, we want to make sure we're sending them to resources that will be informational, that are not going to do more, and we're back at mother blaming again, and not blame parents for the identities of their children, because they just don't have control over that. What they do have control over is outcomes, and I'll talk about this a little bit more on Wednesday, but if you're interested, the Family Acceptance Project is Caitlin Ryan, is a researcher at San Francisco State University. And what she has found is that when parents of LGBT kids are less rejecting, we're not even talking about flying a rainbow flag and marching in a pride parade, if they are less rejecting, negative outcomes of those children significantly increase. Suicide rates go down, number of sexual partners go down, alcohol substance use abuse goes down. And of course, if those parents are actually supportive, it's way better. But when we look at the negative outcomes of kids who experience rejection versus not rejection, Not rejection is a pretty low bar. But if they cannot be rejected, they do a lot better. So, you know, that's where I really encourage people to have the conversations. Let's not worry about nail polish and focus more on what do kids really need. You know, what contributes to well-being in terms of their long-term outcomes. So I have a couple of questions for you to contemplate and some conceptual framing. We won't stay here too long, but I'd like you to think about, you know, what meaning do words have? How does language shape and reflect our identities and the way we talk about ourselves, the way we talk about other people? What do we know about gender identity as though there's something to know? I want to reiterate that idea that knowledge is socially constructed, right? We didn't even have the word transgender a couple of decades ago, right? We weren't talking about gender identity up until, you know, fairly recent history. So, you know, what do we know at this point? What do each of you know or not know or want to know? What does it mean to not be transgender or gender fluid or non-binary? So if you do not identify in a gender diverse way, what does that mean? And as such, what does it mean then to identify on a gender spectrum? And why do we bother having these conversations? And that's where I do want to maybe encourage you all to respond. Why do we have these conversations?
Because we use the word straight, which implies that the other is crooked.
Sure.
And that's why I'm trying to have this conversation.
So we're looking at system, like normative systems.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about social norms is they don't necessarily reflect people's lived experiences. That's where Kinsey's research was so interesting around sexuality, because he was the first to really start researching sex. And he found that what the social norms, especially around the social hygiene movement and how we thought about sex and sexual activity and identities, when he went out and actually interviewed people, it was nothing like what the social norms were. What people were actually doing, feeling, experiences was nothing like what they're supposed to be doing, feeling, and experiencing according to social norms. So we still have normative ideas, and then we have people's actual lived experiences, and that's really where we're exploring. Well, part of why we have these conversations is because discrimination is real. You know, now that we have more mainstream media folks that are coming out, talking more, we have a Chaz Bono, for better or for worse, we have a Caitlyn Jenner, we have a Jazz Jennings, you know, we have people who are in the media. I mean, Jazz Jennings is a young trans woman who I first saw back in 2007 when she did a Barbara Walters special with her family as a very young child, and has since now as an adolescent and is one of the faces of Clean and Clear face products, like has a modeling gig now, has a reality TV show, for better or worse again. I've not seen the show, but reality TV.
Just a children's book.
Yes, and it has a children's book, I Am Jazz. So the whole family has gotten involved in advocating for families, helping parents understand and get connected with appropriate resources. We have those things now. We didn't have those things like when I started interviewing people and started doing this work. Those kinds of resources didn't really exist. Discrimination is real. The National Transgender Discrimination Survey, which is put together by the NCT, and I'm a little sleep deprived, and now I'm forgetting my acronym, and I was going to write it out, and then I didn't. I talk about this all the time, I'll remember. The National Center for Transgender Equality, okay, and the LGBT Task Force have collaborated twice now. They did one a couple years ago, and they had about 6,500 respondents in their national transgender survey, which was the biggest survey to date. They just reissued that survey, and they had over 20,000 participants, 25,000, I think, which is huge, because we're not just theorizing now or talking about a sample of, you know, 50. We're talking large scale. What are people's lived experiences, and what is happening? And what is happening is scary. People are being kicked out of their homes. So I live in a state where it is legal to kick you out of your home or fire you from your job if you are suspected to be LGBT. If you are suspected, so you don't even have to have proof, right?
How do they prove it?
Well, you don't have to have proof.
Have to.
Yeah, but if they did, how would they?
Well, they don't even have to prove it. They can just say this is why. And what gets interesting is that in the state, we don't collect data on things that aren't illegal. So if you've experienced housing discrimination and you call the housing authority, do they take your information? No, because no laws are violated. So, and then what gets interesting is when we try to pass non-discrimination legislation, legislators say, well, this isn't happening here, and there's no data that says it is. Mm-hmm. Well, we're not collecting the stinking data. Mm-hmm. You know, so these are the binds that we end up in. But yet we find from these national surveys that trans folks are getting kicked out of their housing. They are more likely to be fired from employment. It's also sometimes hard to get a job. If you had a feminine name at one point in your life and a job history attached to that name, and now you have a masculine name and you're trying to, you know, continue in your career or your job, whatever you have going on, that can be really challenging to gain employment. But then in many states, it's legal to fire you or just not hire you because of that. So, you know, what we're also doing through these actions of allowing legalized discrimination is creating potentially higher rates of poverty among certain groups of people.
Homeless.
And then we understand better why we have considerably higher rates of homelessness among trans youth. Trans youth of color, especially black trans women and girls, are at very high rates, experience very high rates of physical violence, both from known and unknown entities. You know, there are just not, there's data, and we could get into that. It's just, it's dismal and it's scary and it hurts my heart. But we have to talk about it, right? Because it's real and it's happening. GLSEN is a wonderful organization. I encourage you to look it up if you're not familiar. It's the Gay and Lesbian Straight Education Network. They do address gender identity as well, but sometimes just like PFLAG, some of the organizations have existed longer than our dialogue about gender identity. So GLSEN does a survey every couple of years, and this is a survey year. And so their last report was called Harsh Realities, and so they do a school climate survey, a national school climate survey. And so they actually get data from youth who are currently in schools about their experiences. And they're finding that the attrition rates, the dropout rates for trans kids are very high. The bullying is very high. The not feeling like they can trust or will be supported by their teachers or school administration is very high. And that means that they're graduating at lower rates. So if we pair that then with the information we have from adults around housing discrimination and employment discrimination, you know, there's a lot going on. And we're not even talking yet about faith community rejection, family rejection. You know, there are also amazing, beautiful stories of family inclusion and faith inclusion and the way that we are really doing the work that needs to be done to affirm people and support people, but there are still far too many stories of that not happening and people dying. And I have a great friend, Julie Tilson, who's in Minneapolis, and I think Minnesota folks. And she talks about suicide, particularly for this population, as death by transphobia. We tend to personalize it and say, oh, this person was so sad because they were treated badly. We don't hold the culture that they're existing accountable, that we have not created a culture for that person to exist and thrive.
I live in the county where Leila Alcorn lost her life. I work within in a mental health facility within walking distance of where she passed away. For those who don't know, Leila Alcorn was a young person. She was 16, assigned male gender at birth, came out to her family as trans, and the first reaction, and the family was deeply religious, and they loved their child. Let me just make that clear. They loved their child. And they were not able to wrap their minds and hearts around their child being female. And because the friends and teachers were supportive of this child as a female, they removed their child from public school and homeschooled her and cut her off from a lot of her support system. She eventually wrote a suicide note, which was published on Tumblr. She said it on a delay, so it was published the following day. And in the middle of the night, she stepped in front of a semi on I-71. And it, in some ways, it was the shot heard around the world because it started conversations. You know, unfortunately, a young woman had to lose her life for us to start this conversation, but it brought it to maybe a national level that it had never been at before. And so I guess the only thing I want to say in addition to that is that please don't simplify the characters, because it's easy to say, you know, well, the parents were wrong or whatever. These parents loved their child. They did what they thought was best. And so it's, you know, it's not useful to me to play a blame game. It's how can we talk about this so this never happens again?
Okay, thank you.
Do you think that part of the reason that we get these nasty laws is because they're still hanging on to the leftover feelings they had against gay men because they're so afraid of AIDS, the whole AIDS thing? Because that's when we started finding out about the homosexuals, period. I mean, right. We didn't even think about it.
There's some conflation, but I think there is some difference now. I know that some of the legislative talks we've had, and this was a big issue, the HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, got a lot of trouble a couple of years ago because they supported ENDA, so the a national anti-discrimination and employment bill, and they supported removing gender identity from that bill. And here they are supposed to be like the leading, you know, support for LGBT. And it was kind of this, well, we'll come back for you later. And that's what we see happen. So, you know, I think there is some difference in understanding. That probably is the case for some folks. But largely, there is a difference in understanding what sexual orientation and gender identity is. And there is, now there are still gay discrimination. Do not get me wrong on that. But the kinds of, it's still violent discrimination that happens. What we're seeing though in the legal realm tends to really push a perversion of trans people and an advocacy of fear, like, you know, particularly with bathroom bills, where you reduce people to where they want to pee, right? Yeah. So we reduce them to that. And the reality is, what data shows is that trans people are more likely victims of violent crime. And instead it gets flipped, the narrative gets flipped and says, oh, watch out for your girls and your women. They can be harassed by a man in a dress because he'll be protected now. There's not a single incident of that happening. Now, are there incidences of, and this is not, this is just statistically, this is not, I'm not taking a stand on, like, you know, sometimes when you take these comments, they sound like, oh, she's being anti-man. Not at all, love men, right? But where there are statistics are men that are perpetrating violence in bathrooms, but they are not trans. No, they're cisgender men. You know, and that's a whole other issue we can talk about. So it gets really interesting that narrative gets flipped. It's not supported by data. It's not supported by actual, like, legal charges. But that is the rhetoric, and those are the phone calls. That is tons of money from different conservative organizations dumped into auto calling during election seasons and during popular votes. It's problematic and interesting. I don't know, I mean, is there a larger LGBT discrimination that happens? Sure. Are there some misconceptions about trans people and HIV? Sure, I don't know that they're conflating it.
I think that's an old thing, and I was referring to what the kind of things that they might be putting into law, because they're behind the times to the point where they're still thinking about the fear of catching AIDS by kissing somebody. I mean, that was the way it was in the very early time when I first noticed.
Well, we're hearing, what I see happening, at least I'm very active legislatively. I've gone and testified in bills at my state capitol. Well, church has always been political, and these conversations are political. They just are. Sometimes it's more pandering to a base and to a political affiliation than it is about any data facts. I know that there are legislators in North Dakota that say, I know trans people, I know gay people, I personally support them, but my district will never vote me back in. I can't vote that way, obviously. So, you know, it's not even necessarily a reflection of a personal belief or what they think is best for their districts, but it's sometimes the game of politics. So what I want to drive home, though, is, you know, why do we talk about this? People deserve compassion, right? And I think especially in a place like Holden, I do. I bust out the WWJD. Really. Really. Because who is really the greatest social justice activist that worked for the marginalized and the oppressed? The idea that anybody would use scripture to further marginalize and justify violence. When we talk about who's perverting issues, that to me is the greatest perversion. I can't say that in the classroom, but I can say that here. So I want to just point out a couple of important faces I think you should know, because we need to know trans women of color. So, if people familiar with these faces?
Yes.
They've been there? They are?
Mm-hmm.
You want to say it out loud?
One.
Which one?
Upper, the top one.
Laverne Cox, right? Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
This was huge. Was it like, almost 2 years ago? This Time magazine cover, the transgender tipping point. And here's Laverne on the front of Time magazine. This was huge. Laverne, I love Laverne Cox. She was on the Katie Kirk show. And Katie, bless Katie's heart. Bless Katie's heart. She is trying. And Katie, there was another guest whose name is escaping me right now. Again, 5 hours sleep for several days. And she kept wanting to go back to talking about genitals. And Laverne finally said, whoa, hold up, Katie. And you can Google this. It's a great clip. It's not very long. It's really good. And Laverne schools her and says, as long as we keep talking about genitals, we are reducing people's experiences. They are no longer people. We're just thinking about what's below their pants. And when is that ever okay? If I walked up to any single one of you and asked you about your genitals, how would you respond to me? Who the hell do you think you are? We're not talking about that. But for some reason, for trans folks, that's okay. Socially, we've decided that's okay to do. And it happens all the time. And it's not okay. And so she really took Katie to task. And as a result, Katie did some reflecting, and I think still has a little bit of work to do, but she was just involved in the cover of National Geographic magazine, just did a special issue on gender and gender identity. And along with it, there was a special TV show, and Katie Kirk narrated it, and had a piece online that talked about her own short sight and reflected on her own privilege and how she messed up and how Laverne was willing to call her out on it and was willing to come back on her show and to continue having these conversations. Even though it's not Laverne's job to teach Katie about her own marginalization and her privilege, she still did that. And Katie's used that as a platform in a public way. So we see that action of accountability. I mean, we could pick that apart a little bit more. There was some strengths and some problematic pieces of it, but I think it's really important to talk about that and recognize that these things are happening. Janet Mock is incredible. She has another book coming out, if it didn't come out already. Wrote the book, Redefining Realness, My Path to Womanhood, Identity, Love, and So Much More. And has been is a national speaker and author, very well known. And then does anybody know the young woman down at the bottom? This is Cece McDonald. And Cece was walking home one evening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, with a group of her friends, and they started getting kind of called, not catcalled, but some discrimination. They were walking by a bar. And some of the men came out and started to, like a physical altercation. And in self-defense, Cece ended up killing the man who was attacking her.
Whoa.
Cece was arrested. Cece was put in a men's prison. Cece was not allowed access to her hormones, to the support that she needed. Eventually, there was a lot of advocacy, national advocacy around her case. I've heard her speak since now at the Creating Change Conference, that happens every year. She is also working with Laverne. They have put together a documentary to talk about the kinds of violent discrimination and the kinds of legal issues that come up particularly for trans women of color. Because we don't have systems set up. So we think about, you see, young Cece, is it a good idea to put her in a men's prison?
No.
Just your first response?
No.
Probably not so much.
Well, she just got attacked by a guy that,
right,
that she ended up killing. Why would you?
Right. And so the answer sometimes is in the prison systems is they'll put people in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do we know about isolation?
It's suicide.
It's horrible for mental health.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the justification for, well, we're doing it for your safety. And that happens all over the country. But we also know that the outcomes of that are not good either. And the likelihood that a trans person of color will be charged is also higher,
yep,
than their white counterparts, especially white cis counterparts, but even white trans counterparts. So this is why we have to keep talking about this, right?
Yeah, if you read Janet Mock's book, Redefining Realness, there's a really descriptive section in there about what it is like to be a transgender adolescent and to try to survive, and she became a sex worker in order to afford her hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And this is extremely common, people. This is extremely common. And so I really recommend the book just to open your eyes to the reality of the trans experience, because it's her lived experience, but I think it's she talks about a lot of things we just don't talk about.
Well, and we certainly see higher rates of LGBT homeless youth, but particularly homeless youth and trans youth of color, either from experiencing family rejection, experiencing abuse in the home, concerns about abuse or rejection, and then living on the streets and engaging in things like survival sex, where we see these young people being charged with prostitution when they're doing what they need to do to survive, whether that be to purchase food or to purchase hormones. Oftentimes hormones are a lot cheaper on the internet, so they're not necessarily getting the right assessment, dosage, preventative care, access to preventative care, access to appropriate dosing. That's why it's important that we have things like legal exchange programs. And there's a lot of poo-pooing. Why would we advocate? It's a harm reduction model, where if people are going to inject, you know, get their hormones on their own and inject themselves, they should at least have a clean needle to do it. Because that's where we have some of the concerns around HIV transmission and other types of disease transmission, right? These aren't people who are intravenous drug users, but they're doing what they need to do in order to survive. And sometimes survival does mean having their outward appearance reflect how they experience themselves so they can navigate the world. And that sometimes gets reduced. Well, you really need to see a doctor. You really need to do that. Well, if you don't have any money and you don't have parents that consent and you can't go to school because, you know, you don't feel safe there, what do you do? Like, these are kids that are set up in these binds and they're doing the best they can to survive, but by surviving, they can be charged and arrested and put in the wrong jail. You know, it's really, it's hard to say these things. I don't want to sound dismal at the same time. This is the reality of the situation. This is why, especially in faith communities, we need to be having these dialogues and understanding what's happening, which we'll talk about throughout the week. So I'm going to skip this slide because I want to talk a little bit about definitions so that we have some really clear, just conceptual points. Is that okay with everyone? Okay. All right, so I'm going to kind of talk quickly through it, but it's important that we realize that the gender binary that exists, that we understand you're either a boy or you're a girl, is not true. It's not true in all kinds of species, and it's not true in humans either. So intersex conditions refer to a variety of conditions where a person is born with a reproductive or sexual anatomy that doesn't seem to fit our typical definitions of female or male. So what kind of sometimes blows people's minds is that one in about 1,500 to 2,000 births. So we have higher rates of babies born with intersex condition than we do of Down syndrome. Do we know nearly as much about intersex conditions as we do about Down syndrome? Why is that? Why do you think?
People don't talk about sex.
So we don't talk about it. And why don't we talk about it?
Well, we talk about sex, we don't talk about gender.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Sure.
Well, and people will say, you know, the first thing that people ask you, as you were saying, when someone is pregnant is they want to know the sex or gender of the baby. And then when the baby is born with, quote unquote, ambiguous genitalia, people want you to pick a gender. You know, just be clear, pick a gender.
Yep. Some of these don't show up until later in life. And the medical protocol has even changed because what's happened is that intersexed adults have said, what happened to me as a child is not okay. Because the medical protocol used to be, they'll do a surgery. They'll do a genital surgery on an infant, put them on hormones throughout their life. Sometimes those medical records were sealed, that people didn't even know that they were born with an intersex condition. At the time, were called hermaphroditic conditions. Mm-hmm. The word hermaphrodite is a pejorative word. Please do not use it. And it is inaccurate because hermaphrodite refers to what?
Both genders at the same
time. You have both sex, and there is not a single case where somebody has the full reproductive anatomy of both male and female, so it doesn't exist anyway. But intersex is and there are variations from very subtle variations to very obvious physical variations. And the medical protocol changed because adults said, this wasn't okay. You performed a surgery on my genitals as an infant, and now I have no sexual sensation. Or, you know, the model actually was a little, I kid you not, a ruler. Mm-hmm. And the micropenis, if the micropenis was big enough, they would be raised as a boy. If it wasn't, they would default that child to a girl and perform surgery accordingly. So this is a bigger problem than, you know, this isn't a new problem. This has been happening for decades. But these are movements that are connected because they reflect the way we conceptualize and think about gender and sex and gender identity and children.
Was that an automatic thing, or are there people that didn't have that surgery as they were born to compare?
It was generally, the movement, there's a great book called Intersex and Identity, written actually by a professor from Minnesota, so there's a couple of Midwesterners here, and I'm forgetting her name at the moment because I just can't seem to retain names today, and she really focuses on that movement, and it was primarily adults who as children had had the surgeries performed on them. And it was pretty standard medical protocol, so I don't know that there is much of a population of folks whose it wasn't. The people who seem to have come forward that weren't tended to come from oftentimes religious communities where they didn't believe in those kinds of surgeries, or they didn't believe in, like, you know, traditional Western medicine. So those children might have not had surgeries, but for the most part, it wasn't like when, I'm going to use the comparison to Down syndrome. Now, these are very, very different conditions, but in terms of support and advocacy, you have a Down syndrome child that's born, what's the first thing the doctors do? I'm going to connect you to other parents who have Down kids. We're going to, you know, you're going to see a specialist. We're going to give you all these resources, right? For years and years and years, intersex baby was born, those parents were isolated, and they were encouraged to pick a surgery. You can't not register your child, you know, you can't go to kindergarten and not pick boy or girl. You have to pick one, and their body
was reflected that. You can't fill out a birth certificate.
Right, absolutely. So that practice is changing. It's not where it needs to be, but it's changing. But I bring that up here because it's important for us to be conceptualizing this and to think about even the words not natural. Do you sometimes hear that in the political or the social commentary? It's not natural. Well, how are we defining what's natural?
Right.
Is it? Is it not? So in terms, I've used these terms. So when I talk about sex, what we're referring to, what the literature talks about, is the classification of people as male or female. And so that's that assignment that I talked about based on chromosomes, hormones, internal reproductive organs, genitals. So we're talking about bodies most of the time when we're talking about sex. When we're talking about gender, this is that those socially constructed attributes that are related to being a man or a woman, feminine or masculine. And we see a lot of conflation of language. So on medical forms, I see this all the time. What is your gender, male, female? Male and female are sex markers. If you're gonna ask me my gender, you would say man or woman. So, but this happens all the time, right? Not, and I don't go tell the doctor, you got this wrong, but I'm just aware of how prevalent those the blurring of those are between what we would consider maybe medical, sex, bodily, versus what are some of the social norms. And then as we're talking about gender identity, I guess I shouldn't define this thing really early, but how do people experience themselves? So what is the person's deeply held sense of their own gender regardless of what they're assigned at birth? And we all have one. It's just if we're cisgender, which I'll talk about a little bit in a second, we don't have to think about it. But everybody has a gender identity. Everybody has a sexual orientation.
And I didn't understand. Was it when Caitlyn Jenner came out, and I remember watching that interview, and her saying, you know, my sexual orientation has nothing to do with my gender identity. And for me, growing up in Utah, and, you know, the clothes, whatever, I really had to sit and think about that. Why are they different? Mm-hmm. And so I understand it a little bit more now.
Yeah.
But that, it definitely, is that question.
It's a great point, because there are trans people who identify as straight. There are trans people who identify as bi or queer or gay. And, you know, depending on how they're being read by somebody, so if somebody is maybe a little bit transphobic, which we'll talk about that, but they don't see that person as the gender that they identify, and then they're partnered with somebody that they see that as a different gender, but that person sees as the same gender, they might be saying, well, look, you're straight anyway. Well, that person's saying, no, actually, I'm a lesbian. I identify as a woman and I'm attracted to women. I identify as a lesbian because they're sexual oriented. And so the question sometimes will come up with people who aren't really getting it is, well, if you like women anyway, why can't you just stay a man? Right? Like, these are the kinds of conversations that happen, and these happen in churches. These kind of conversations have happened with, people who are in their middle or older adults that have been married and stayed married after a partner transitions, and the pastor just can't understand why. And that's come up in some of my interviews. I'll talk about that on Friday. Okay, but so just a couple more terms. I'm also aware of time. I have about 15 minutes. Okay. So expressions of gender. We're talking about gender expression. We're talking about how people present themselves in the world and navigate through the world in the way their mannerisms, their haircuts, their clothing. But this is also an important term. And I think this is important as we think about children. The term gender creative. Non-conforming, we're seeing less of that language because it assumes that there's a way to conform to gender. But if gender is socially constructed, is there a right way to do your gender? It's constantly changing, so I like to complicate that a little bit. But the term gender creative was coined by, Erin Saft. Erin Saft, begins with an E, wrote the book Gender Born, Gender Made. And this is so that we're not also diagnosing young children, because some kids are going to express themselves in gender diverse ways. Some of them will be trans. Some of them will be gender queer. Some of them will be cisgender. You know, we don't know when they're young, but rather than grouping people or thinking about them from a medical framework, she uses the word gender creative to talk about people whose experiences exist outside of stereotypical gender expectations. And there are a lot of gender creative folks around. Okay, and so when we're using the language transgender, we're talking about people whose gender identity is different from their assigned gender at birth. And that's a personal identity. And then that language I keep using, cisgender. So, and I defined it earlier, but a person whose gender identity is in line with their gender assigned at birth. And so we'll talk a little bit about some of the privileges and the things we don't have to think about, which help us to then maybe understand the things that other people do have to think about. I'm gonna quickly touch on something that is related to something you brought up, and that is around, you asked about legislation, but it's very interesting to see how political movements are related to what we consider to be medical truths. So the DSM, everybody familiar with the DSM? It's the big book of mental health diagnoses. Gets revised. Diagnoses change. Some interesting pieces. So in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexual as a diagnosis. That's a really great reminder of language. The word to call somebody homosexual is pejorative. You rarely hear somebody say, this is my identity. It's a word that was developed to institutionalize people. So unlike the word gay, it has always had a negative connotation. Yeah. So it was removed as a diagnosis. So there's also that argument that it's no longer a diagnosis. Why are we still using diagnostic terms from something that was removed in 1973? What's interesting is that at the same time that was removed, gender identity disorder was added into the DSM. So now, in the latest version of the DSM, gender identity disorder has been removed again, but we see gender dysphoria. So rather than diagnosing somebody's identity, which used to be the case, and kind of still is, dysphoria refers to somebody's discomfort with their body based on their own experience of their gender. So did they actually experience psychological distress? That would be gender dysphoria. Here's the issue. For people who want to transition or have any kind of medical coverage, whether it be a surgery, hormone treatment, what have you, they oftentimes need to hold a mental health diagnosis in order to move forward with any kind of medical treatments. So that means that we have folks that have to get diagnosed with a mental health condition in order to have their bodies aligned with their own sense of their gender, which actually can help people's mental health. And for some people, not. It also, there are lots of ways to be trans. There are lots of ways to be gender creative. Not every trans person has any desire to change their body at all. So that's another misnomer too, that people tend to think, like, if you're trans and you're the surgery, and when we say the surgery, what are people referring to?
Bottom surgery.
Right? Are we supposed to talk about that? Mm-mm. So don't ask about surgery ever. But that's our point of reference, right? And we're not talking about people's experiences, that there are plenty of trans folks that will never undergo hormone treatments or ever undergo the knife, be it because they can't afford it, that's a huge issue, or because they choose not to, because they're okay with their bodies and they're not okay with the way society defines them.
Useful language around that is people talk about social transition and medical transition, and they are not necessarily the same thing. Some people may socially transition if they were assigned one gender at birth and they choose to live as another gender. never having any medical intervention of any kind. So that's useful terminology to have that conversation.
And an hour and 15 minutes is not nearly enough.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we're going to talk more about that.
A whole semester.
What was the date of that? What's the most recent?
The newest,
last year.
It came out sooner, and then we started having to use it last year.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
3 years
ago.
You know,
we can talk about ICD-10.
And so it also taught, that also helps us remember, the DSM is a living document.
Yeah.
It changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we can think about other things too, like Asperger syndrome is no longer in the DSM. It is now autism spectrum disorders.
Good.
You know, so things like bipolar used to be manic depression. We don't call it manic depression anymore. It's bipolar. So as we have more information, research, and then the political climate of our mental health communities, all of those things contribute to what we consider to be mental health truths. And so I'm going to say those truths are little t, not a capital T.
Mm-hmm.
And they change.
Well, then all those things are viewed through the medical model.
Yes, and there's that. And medicalizing trans bodies is a whole other issue. If we go back to our conversation about, especially like trans youth that live in poverty or are homeless, you know, we hear stories of kids that are being convicted because they were pumping silicone and pumped for their friends, and then one of the friends died from the toxicity because they were using builder grade silicone. But these are kids
to create feminized breasts.
Yes.
Is what she's talking about.
So, you know, like we all go, oh my God, and I do that, oh my God, why would you do that? And at the same time, if you are experiencing that kind of gender dysphoria and feel like your body doesn't match the way you see yourself and that you're not able to pass publicly and you feel like you need to do that, if you are surviving on the money or the goods made from survival sex and you need to have a more feminized body, there's all of these pieces that contribute to this that we oftentimes just don't have to think about. Most of us don't have to think about these things, so we don't. And that's where my next question comes, and that is, what's privilege got to do with it? And I can send out an email to some of these resources, but there's a great, there's a WordPress site where the author uses a variation of Peggy McIntosh's White Privilege Checklist. If you're not familiar with that, it's a great resource to look at. I suggest looking at it. And I'm going to pull up just a couple. We don't have time to go through all of them in depth.
Ooh.
But the kinds of things that we can think about. And I'll read some of these because I know that's tiny text. It would have taken a really long PowerPoint to get to it all. But some things that we can think about is if we identify as cisgender or we are labeled cisgender, it's unlikely that I will be ostracized by my family and friends, fired from my job, evicted from my home, given substandard medical care, suffer violent or sexual abuse, ridiculed in the media, or preached against by religious organizations simply because my professed identity or perceived incongruent gender behaviors or characteristics. I don't ever have to worry about that. Nobody does that. Right? I can be confident that people will not call me by a different name or an improper pronoun. I've never suffered the indignation of holding it when both functional and unoccupied public restrooms are available. In fact, I don't need to be concerned about public facilities segregated by sex. If I'm institutionalized, I don't have to worry about being housed in the wrong section of facilities segregated by sex. This also happens in mental health institutions. So we see higher rates of suicidality and substance abuse in trans folks because of the way they are treated socially. Being trans does not cause you to have substance abuse issues or have a higher suicidality. Being treated really badly by the people who care or supposed to care about you or the systems that you function in or are supposed to function in, that does. And then I spoke in one of my research projects, spoke to a mom who herself is a mental health provider and had a child who had disclosed their transgender identity. And mom, already being connected, could not find a facility that could treat this child appropriately. This is a kid that was actively suicidal, but they wanted to house that child in the wrong gender area. So this is even a mom who's a professional in the area, does know the questions to ask, does know how to navigate these systems, and couldn't find the appropriate resources for her own kid. Because they're becoming better, but they're far, far, far from where they need to be to really provide good services. I will only experience puberty once. That's really hard for folks. Taking hormones does induce a second puberty. I don't have to worry about that. I did it once. That's not a fun time for people.
No.
For lots of reasons. Bodily changes, emotional changes. I mean, there's a reality to that. And I don't have to even think about it. I'm unlikely, we've talked about this, I'm unlikely to be questioned about my genitals, even less likely to be touched inappropriately or asked to see them. I have a friend who is also a mental health provider in a school, and her child just in recent history, young elementary school, the little girls would stand outside the restroom and not allow this child access because they didn't believe this child was a girl and would insist that she show them what was in her pants.
Whoa.
This is happening in the Fargo-Moorhead region.
It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, it's happening everywhere. But for those of you, you know, like this is, it's close to home. It's happening. It happens all the time. And this is a mom who's connected to the school as well. So we don't have to worry about those kinds of things. Issues that are really significant, I think, are when we start talking about the restroom access as well as preventative health. So where do people go for not only transition health, but preventative health? Because in many states, it's legal for a physician to discriminate. If there's no protections, it's legal. And that happened to my friend who's very public, and he has given me permission to talk about this. He was the head of Trans Ohio, actually, the former director. And when that first trans survey that I talked about was released at the Creating Change Conference, he participated in the press conference and talked about his own experience having a physician set up that he knew was trans-friendly. This is a man, he is bald, he's got a full beard, he's awesome, but if he walked in the room, you don't generally misgender him. He identifies as a man, he looks like a man, he navigates the world as a man. However, he had a UTI. And when he went to the walk-in clinic on the weekend because his physician wasn't available, they not only violated HIPAA by talking about his case out in public in the open, but that physician refused to see him. So he went home, ended up with a kidney infection. This is somebody who has health insurance. This is somebody who started the state organization to advocate, especially for kids, but advocate for other trans folks. If it happens to him, think about how many stories are untold. You know, and this is a very basic, any of us should be able to go to the doctor, get an antibiotic, and get rid of a UTI, or strep throat, or whatever it is. None of us should be ridiculed.
Preventative cancer screenings, too. If you're a guy and you still own a cervix.
Well, there's the...
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, now 15 minutes is even starting to talk about, you know, all of the places we can go.
Or not.
So I know we're about out of time, so I want to make sure that we have this shared definition that I think is so important, because I want us to move into positions of advocacy and allyship. And this is my favorite definition of an ally. You know, allies don't get cookies. That I think that's really important. There are, and we see this in faith communities too. I'm the person who does the advocacy work, therefore I'm a really good person. We shouldn't be doing this because we need to be seen as really good people. We should be doing this because it's the right thing to do and we want to be inclusive to people. And so that's why I love this definition, because it says an ally is someone who recognizes they are on the side, a privileged side of a particular prejudice and or oppression divide created by society. The ally then actively engages in a search and implementation of strategies to dismantle that divide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's about stepping up, showing up and stepping up, right?
Yeah.
It's about, you know, when we're in Target and we see kids ridiculing somebody who's buying shoes, standing next to them, telling the kids to go away. I mean, it's sometimes little things like that. It might be marching in a pride parade. It might be talking with people in your dinner table. Dinner tables are the places of change. That is how marriage was won in Minnesota. There was a campaign to share personal stories, and it worked on a popular measure ballot. Civil rights were not won on popular measure, like popular ballots. But it happened when people started sharing their stories. So it's important that we hear stories, that we tell stories. We don't tell other people's stories, but we tell our own. Well, my friend, or this person, or this is why I think that's okay, or that's not okay. You know, we're not supposed to talk about these things at Thanksgiving, but why? Why not? You know, when we're in community with people that we're most close with. And that's something that for years for me, this is embarrassing to say, but I will. When I came out, my mom was not supportive, so then I didn't talk about anything about my research. She would brag to her friends about me getting a PhD, because like every good mom, you know, that has a kid in grad school who's losing their mind, but would not talk about my dissertation, because I didn't talk about my dissertation. And my dissertation was interviewing couples where one partner identified as trans. And it just was somewhere she didn't want to go, I didn't want to go. And it shifted over time, thank goodness. But I thought, how am I doing the service that I say needs to be done when I won't talk to my own family about the things that I'm going out and lecturing and interviewing and saying I'm an advocate? You know, it's just, it's so important to sometimes take those risks, to also know safety. There are places sometimes where, you know, you won't argue somebody into agreeing with you.
Well, and with that, I mean, I just remember hearing a speaker years ago, when you get in that situation, I mean, I'm thinking about my family. I mean, something come up at a dinner table, Thanksgiving, and it's inflammatory against. To say nothing is kind of agreeing, but at least say, I just need you to know, I think differently. Don't have to get into an argument.
And sometimes, I even add to that, I think differently, or,
and.
I believe every person deserves compassion.
There, yeah.
People have a really hard time arguing with that. No, they don't.
The dignity of every human being.
You know, so it doesn't have to be that everybody has to understand gender and gender identity and go out and march in pride parades, although those are all great things. But when we're talking with somebody who we hear using maybe disrespectful language or hurtful language or is disparaging to somebody, bullying, any of those kinds of behaviors, that we can step up and say, you know, does anybody, I don't care what you think about gender identity issues, doesn't every child deserve access to a fair education? Are you really going to argue with me about access to education? I mean, you know, so sometimes there are points of connection that we can say, okay, I don't have to get it in order to say yes. And in order to have access to education, what do you have to be able to do?
School.
What do you have to do if you're going to school? You have to be able to pee. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that sounds silly, but you do. Like, we're still having these conversations. I moved to North Carolina. I have my work cut out for me. Because mm-hmm. That is the state that is leading the charge. And has lost millions, if not billions, of dollars in state revenue. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, even the NCAA, or was it ACC? Yeah. NCAA moved the major basketball tournaments out of North Carolina over these measures. So allyship means calling your legislators, both your state and your local, your federal. You know, those are things that we can do that take literally two minutes of our time that make a difference. So anyway, I think we could go on and on and on, but why don't I end here? Is there anything that you all want to make sure we touch on as we are wrapping up, because it is time for lunch? And what I want to invite you to do on your way out is there's a piece of paper, you can't really see it on the whiteboard. Make sure you get the actual paper. But what I'm asking, what I'd like you to do is if there is a word that comes up or a phrase, or something that you're thinking about right now as you are contemplating this conversation and leaving here, if you would write that word or phrase on that piece of paper, I think sometimes a powerful representation, visual representations can be powerful and great reminders, and also it helps me to understand a sense of where we are as a community in this conversation today. So if you wouldn't mind grabbing a marker and sharing. And if you're interested, there are some resources on the website they've listed. I've submitted some websites as well as some books that I highly recommend for supporting youth. One is called The Transgender Child, the other is called The Transgender Teen. They're like $12 online, they're paperbacks, they're easy to read, and they are full of really, really fantastic information based in research, but written for a wide audience. So if you're interested in learning more about those, the printouts are here and that describe the text. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.